January 22, 1981, California State University at Long Beach. William O'Neill, interviewed by Kay Brigo.
I established kind of taxonomy in the book that I'm just finishing up on political philosophies, in which it ranges on a continuum from what I call educational fundamentalism, which is pretty obvious in both its religious and secular aspects, all the way over to educational anarchism, the Ivan Illich, Paul Goodman kind of orientation. Looking at education in general in this country, I would say the two positions in the middle, educational conservatism, which is kind of mainstream republicanism in its political orientation as it applies over education, and educational liberalism, which is something between John Dewey and kind of small-d democratic, orientation as it applies to education. I think there's always been a tremendous tension in American education, particularly between those two things. We tend to have a rhetorical commitment in the liberal direction, but what we really do is pretty conservative. And I think that's pretty characteristic of what Cal State Long Beach has always done. When I was out here as a student, I think it was probably, good God, let me think. It was probably in the same ambivalent situation with respect to liberalism and conservatism it is at the present time. I would say probably because the country is more conservative today, the education department is more conservative as well. Although I was here just at the end of the Truman era as a student and before, the beginning of the Eisenhower years, and those were fairly conservative times too. I think the education department here at Cal State Long Beach and has always been certainly conservative compared to the other departments on campus, except for those departments that are always notoriously conservative, like home economics and vocational ed and physical science and areas like that. The history department has always been, I think the history department tends to be the one branch in, I hope I'm not stepping on your toes saying this, but I think history departments tend to be quite conservative as compared to sociology departments or political science departments or so on. Maybe because they deal with the past and you get a certain vested interest in what has been. But I felt the education department out here was generally conservative with always a few exceptions. But the mainstream was conservative then. I think it's conservative now, although my feeling for the, is it a division or a school, or what is it now?
School of education.
For the school of education here isn't terribly strong at the moment, because I used to drop around when my friends were still here and chat with them once in a while, because I only lived down on the peninsula. And then the parking got more hectic and my friends began retiring, and I don't think, I come around once in a while because I do some writing with George Demas, who was in the Council of Ed department. He used to be Dean of Activities after I left here for a period of time. But other than dropping into the library and seeing Demas, I almost never talk to anyone when I'm out here. When I was here as a faculty member, we were constantly embroiled in political hassles. I came in at the time when we were having the Great Revolution against P. Victor Peterson. It was just beginning. I came in 57 while I was finishing my dissertation at USC. I got my degree in June of 58, so I got my degree about 7 months after I was here as a faculty member. And I came in the same year that Norma Gibbs came in and was still here in either counseling or education. I don't know if you've met Norma or not, but I came in 57, I left in 61, I was here 4 years. And in that time, I think we got rid of Peterson. That took about 2 years, and the faculty were all involved in this in various sundry ways. There were factions, and people were locked in offices, as they, I'm sure they are today, drinking coffee and smoking and plotting against the evil administration. And the administration, of course, was in its paranoid little circles, talking about all of these terrible people on the faculty, the usual stuff that goes on on all campuses all the time. But when I came in, they were very successful in getting rid of Peterson, which I personally was very ambivalent about, because I was here, you know, when there were 50 students on campus, then 100, then maybe 600, 800 when I left, and I knew all of these people as friends. There was a time when the students, when I was a student, when the students and the faculty would all sit outside the lunch bar, and the president knew everyone, and everyone knew all members of the faculty, and all of that kind of thing. So with all of his failings, I felt very, very sorry to see, you know, what was going on, because he was not a bad person. He did a lot of very good things for the college, but he had a...
What kind of good things did he do?
Well, he was a very stable person. He was a very well-meaning person. I don't think he was terribly enlightened in his point of view about education, things I've talked about before, you know, hiring hordes of Scandinavian faculty from the Middle West and all of that kind of thing. He was old school. He was a chemistry professor who had become, I think, vice president at San Jose or something before he came here. And it was a time when that kind of person gravitated, seemed to move into positions much more readily than they do today. He was older. He tended to bring in an older, more ossified group of people on the whole. And then they seemed to ossify even further when they reached campus for some strange reason. Sea change seemed to hit them or something. But he went and was replaced, as I recall, by McIntosh.
Yeah, but before you get to that,
sure.
You were a colleague of Professor Martin and Professor Black.
Mm. Yeah, I knew Frank Black and Clyde Martin very, very well. I can't even remember exactly what the problems were there. At that time, I knew I could have recited, you know, all of the charges back and forth. I can't even remember exactly what happened. I know that they both left, and Clyde Martin died of a heart attack soon thereafter. Or soon as happened after every campus coup and revolution, people drop dead for about 3 or 4 years from the tension and the after effects. It's really a shame. Can you remind me what the problems were with Martin and Black?
They were not kept on. One of them, I think Professor Martin wasn't given tenure, and Professor Black simply wasn't kept on. He wasn't up for tenure. And they were recommended by, I guess it was at that time, the Division of Education.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Peterson decided that he didn't go along with that, and he dismissed them.
Well, as I recall, and this is... Well, this is really kind of vague recollection, because it's been a while. Both Martin and Black were... They were not leaders in the insurrection against the president and the... As I was saying, Martin and Black were definitely identified with the opponents of the administration and with the opponents of the then dominant group in the School of Education. But to save myself, I can't remember who the dean or the division chairman or whatever he was called.
Wally
Moore. Yeah, Wally Moore. Well, Wally was an absentee landlord. Wally was one of those great shaggy characters who was always wandering around the world doing marvelous things in Pakistan and being gone for 3 years and coming back and running for office and that kind of thing. Sort of bigger than life kind of individual. Very nice person, but I think there was a great discontent. I'm not sure it was Moore. There may have been somebody acting in place of Moore. It seemed like it was Kiefer's kinsman, but I can't remember. It was someone like that. But there was also there was a concurrent attempt to oust the chairman or the dean or whatever it was at the School of Education, the Division of Education at that time. And Black and Martin were identified with the opponents, I think rightly so. As I recall, Martin was very instrumental in the attempt to found a teachers union. I think it was the AFT. I was a member, but the meetings were so boring I can't remember exactly what happened at the time. But he was focally involved in that, and I think that probably they were released primarily for those reasons. I think there were good reasons to release both of them quite apart from all of that. They were certainly unimpressive people and not particularly strong faculty members. Clyde was a very strange person. I think he had, what's the word I'm searching for? Not petty mal seizures, but he had a tendency to fall asleep once in a while, and sometimes even in class, which does not come across terribly well. But I think it was a medical problem. He was no fool, but he was he had medical problems with possible psychological, correlates. And anyway, I think they were dismissed for the wrong reasons, but I think you could have made a good chart. However, you could dismiss a good part of the faculty for the same reasons they were dismissed, as is generally true in most situations. They were selected for, I think, their political actions rather than their ineptitude. I think there was a certain amount of ineptitude operating, but many of the people charging them with ineptitude would have been open to the same kind of charges. I was surprised they let Black go. Black was not as vehement or tactless in what he was doing as Martin was, but for some strange reason, maybe because they were just coming up at that time, I guess it was their tenure year or something, and that this was just, they had tenure? Were they fired for cause? Can't remember.
Neither of them had tenure.
Yeah, I think it was...
They were fired without cause. That was one of the reasons that became involved.
Yeah, I think it was the last opportunity that the administration had to get rid of them without cause. And once somebody gets tenure, of course, they have to molest children or something before they're released.
And they were outside of kids.
If he did, they weren't children.
Well, then that's what he was charged with.
These were both veterans. My God, they were Army veterans charging Ross's party with leading them down an immoral road, which was humorous. I mean, I knew both Jim Vile and Gordon Pond very, very well, and they were adult men. It's ridiculous, that they would... I have a feeling that there was some kind of operation behind the scenes there, because although this was the benighted early 50s, people were not that shocked with, possible homosexual acts among adults, on a field trip in Baja, California, whenever all of this was supposed to have happened. It was very bad news as far as I was concerned. I don't know what Ross's sexual predilections were, but he was an awfully nice person, and he was an excellent teacher, and he was a very good friend of the two guys that made the charges against him. They came at a time of great faculty furor, when there were charges and there were cliques forming, and the feeling of the faculty, which of course, you get at the time, is they were bought off. The administration got to them and said, we will place you, or we will hire you, or whatever, we'll take care of you if you, take care of this man, because Hardy was a leader of the insurrection, and quite outspoken in his, soft-spoken way, as opposed to Bob Ross in the psychology department, who was just, and Hugh Brown, who were vehement against them, people like this, and much more effective, I think, because they were constantly haranguing students and other faculty about the ineptitude of the administration, which was bad taste on their part. They may have been right very often, but it was very bad judgment on their part to be right in that particular mode.
I got you off the subject that you were talking about, which is Martin and Black.
What was that? Yeah, I really can't remember that much more about Martin and Black. If you can think of any specifics, perhaps let me know.
What did you think about the faculty council that was formed then? Were you a part of that?
Yeah, I was.
Your colleague, Mike Gardner, was a leader.
Yeah. Thank God you've got a good memory since you've never seen these people.
I've heard about.
Mike Garver was a very salty, outspoken individual, a very nice guy, a good teacher, a unique personality. He became very embittered toward the end. And he died soon after I left the college, I think about 62 or 63, at a relatively young age. I think he was in his late 50s or mid 50s or something. Your concept of what is a relatively young age changes as you grow older and so on. Mike was very much involved in it, and then after the insurrection won out, he really retreated. He became kind of a burnt out case. He retreated into his office. He came to school when necessary. He took care of business and stayed away. He was instrumental, I think, in the beginning of the faculty council, as I recall. I was too, to a certain extent, but that kind of thing is one of those necessary evils I sometimes get involved with, and it bores me at the time, and I repress it right afterwards. I was even on it. It never lived up to its promise, as these things generally don't.
In what respect did it live up to its promise? I mean, the people who were on it were able to force the administration to let the faculty have some say in hiring and promotions and one thing and another that are kind of generally accepted ways to run colleges and universities.
Yeah, in that sense, I guess a little bit of its promise is just that it's very hard to get committees to do anything very effectively, whether they're called committee faculty counselors or whatever, and you get a mix of people. I think probably the first couple of years when you had the prime insurrectionists on the council, Metzger, Garber, George Korber, Metzger in business, basically Korber in sociology, I can't remember who else was on. Walt Nagel in education, I think, was on the council. Richard Wilde in history. Is Wilde still here?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Wilde has switched sides a few times. He's been in the administration, and he's been out fighting them, and I always have to check. There are a lot of the people. That's Hal Malem, who was here for a long time, who retired, I guess, just recently. Hal had the gift of being a faculty leader who was on the faculty and a strong administrator, the spokesman for the administration was on the administration. Whenever he changed sides, he seemed to make the transition with great grace, which is very, very rare. But I was amazed to find out after I left that Wilde had gone into the administration because if anyone was, you know, wildly anti-administration, at least in the context of the times that I was around, it was Dick Wilde. When these people were on the council, I think it was probably much more effective. I think all of these things are much more effective when the memory of the, you know, of the bad old days is still fresh. But it seemed to get rapidly deteriorated into a debating society, and it began to factionalize. And I think also there was a tendency on the part of the administration, either wittingly or unwittingly, to find the faculty leaders and buy them off by offering them sub-administrative positions with the promise of moving upward and outward and all of that kind of thing.
Peterson apparently didn't do that very effectively, though.
No, he wasn't. Pete was not very effective. He was. I think he became increasingly embittered in his last couple of years. He would sit in evening meetings with his sunglasses on, which is not necessarily indicative of anything, but is not exactly, you know, Midwestern standard apparel, and probably indicates, you know, he just wanted to block out as much of what was going on as possible. He had some fairly strong people around him. Dave Bryant was a very effective person, and was probably the major real opponent of the faculty. You know, beneath the rhetoric directed at Peterson was a lot of real animosity directed at Dave Bryant. Who else was in the administration at that time?
Dr. Bratton and Dr. Rhodes.
Rhodes was controversial. I don't think anybody other than people that are just sort of characterologically predisposed to be bitchy were necessarily opposed to Rhodes and Bratton on any principle except the fact that they were associated with the administration. The whole fight was very tough on Bob Rhodes, and he died of a heart attack soon thereafter. He was one of the people that I think it got to. Bratton was not a controversial. It was no one anyone was ever after. I think everyone basically liked Wes Bratton.
And the same perhaps with Frenchie Flynn.
Yeah, everyone liked Frenchie Flynn. Frenchie didn't have any enemies, but again, it was hard for him to have friends because he was in the administration. I think the animosity was basically directed against Peterson and against Bryant. Viewed almost as a team, almost like, you know, Nixon and Kissinger in the eyes of the faculty. Bryant was the hatchet man, and Peterson was the gray eminence behind him at all times. I forgot some of these names. I'm glad you're reminding me.
But you didn't see the faculty council as really being effective then. I mean, who got rid of Peterson? And what forced him out if it wasn't the faculty council and the steering committee?
You know, I honestly can't remember. I think these things go on for a couple of years, and if they're not solved, they become profoundly embarrassing to the Board of Trustees or whoever was, you know, working with Peterson at that time. They become embarrassing to the community, they become embarrassing to the state authorities, and ultimately they simply say, put your house in order or, you know, we will replace you, either directly or indirectly, that word gets across. I think what happened is Pete just didn't effectively solve his problems. I don't think anyone can after a period of time. He was in for, from 49 until
59,
10 years. I think it's about 5 years more than the average person should stay in an administrative position anyway. I don't think, you know, it should be indefinite tenure once a person gets in. And I think if he'd left in 55, he probably would have gone out with great commendation and, you know, bouquets and everything. He just didn't want to relinquish power like many people. He enjoyed it. He enjoyed the position. And he couldn't control the situation. And I'm not so sure that it wasn't, I don't know, a normal psychological phenomenon. I think, you know, that faculties periodically, there are so many tensions on campuses. I think the most political places in the world are college and university campuses. Woodrow Wilson once said he was so delighted to be elected president because the politics at Princeton were driving him crazy. And I sympathize with him. I know when I first went to USC, I was so delighted to be in a private university where the decisions were all made at the top. And, you know, there was no question of ousting the president because the president was, you know, the agent of the Board of Trustees. We had no teachers' unions. It was marvelous. I just did my job and went home and came to school. And I was so politic out by the time I left this place at the end of 4 years that I had never heard of another, you know, terrible miscarriage of justice by the administration that would have delighted me. But
that happened at USC, too. Come on. Eventually forced von Kleinschmidt out.
Oh, not the faculty. No. No, von Kleinschmidt would still be there if he were still alive. The only thing I think that's ever forced a president or a vice president out at USC is an internal fight within the central administration, as has occurred just recently where we just had three vice presidents. Well, of course, we have a new president, but the new president came and immediately released three of the vice presidents, a couple of whom have been there for a long, long time, and we just lost our dean in the School of Education. That was a typical back-ending fight, like the kind we had back in 57 through 61. But there's nothing like that. Nothing like that's occurred at USC. The fights at USC to make a difference are fights between the president and the Board of Trustees. The Faculty Senate is not very effective. The faculty representative groups, the president's advisory council, all of them are window dressing. It's a benevolent paternalism at USC. How benevolent it is, I don't know. It was paternalism. And that's what Peterson ran, a benevolent paternalism here. But he became an embarrassment to the state, and if enough people bring accusations long enough, they're going to investigate, and if they investigate and the whole thing becomes visible and embarrassing, ultimately they're going to let the person go and bring in someone else. And I think that's the reason, you know, he was ousted. God knows many of the people that replaced him were no better than he was. They were just different. And I would say inside the first year that McIntosh came here, he was under attack. He scarcely had a grace period.
Okay, before you, we get into McIntosh,
yeah.
I'm interested in how you got hired.
I'm trying to think. How did I get hired?
I mean, that was one of the issues that divided the faculty
and the
administration. What? How people got hired? Yeah, because, well, you remember the story about the history department, that it was Dr. Alquist and Dr. Mala.
Yeah.
And they were both U.S. historians, and they were hopefully sitting around waiting for a European historian. When Dr. Wilby and Dr. Kimball arrived, were both British historians. Because Dr. Peterson did all the hiring himself. So
they
had four historians and two specialties.
You know, I honest to God cannot remember how I got hired, except that I think I was probably the first graduate of this university to ever receive a doctorate. I'm almost sure I was. And I knew everyone, and that was a time when college jobs were very easy to get. I mean, there were all kinds of positions. There was no... quite contrary to being a shortage, there was a tremendous shortage of teachers. And this was just, I like the Long Beach area. I'm a confirmed Southern Californian, so I wanted to stay here. And I would assume that Peterson and Bryant probably made the decision. I think the decisions regarding faculty hiring were almost entirely done by the central administration at that time. I really don't think the schools had an awful lot to do with it. I think suddenly, you know, in September, people appeared that had been screened by the president.
Did your specialty make a contribution to the education department? I mean, obviously you did personally, but was the thing that you've done your dissertation about useful in teaching the courses that they assigned to you?
No, it wasn't. In fact, what I got my degree in educational philosophy, my supplementary was in educational psychology, and I taught educational psychology almost entirely for the 4 years I was here. At that time, however, again, there weren't that many teachers. They were all teaching across areas. In fact, you know, when I was here, Alquist taught sociology, Metzger taught geography. Everyone in the education department taught across departments on the whole. And finally, they had a little clustering, and I was in the ed psych department along with Bill Fogg and Clive Martin and people like this. I would have taught Gordon Warner, who was here at that time, who retired and went to Japan. He now lives in Kadena, Okinawa. Gordon Warner had first claim on ed philosophy because he had taught the philosophy course before, although his degree from UC Berkeley was in vocational education and guidance. And at that time, the feeling was, you know, except for administration, where you really had to have face validity as having been a superintendent or a principal or something like that, in the theory areas, as long as you had a degree in the foundations area generally, they didn't discriminate that much here between psych foundations and social foundations and history. It was more a matter of who was here first, who had established the territory, and whether you could break into it or not, that kind of thing. Warner and I ordinarily, ultimately worked out an entente where I taught the occasionally, I think once every year we taught a course in educational philosophy, which was not required, so we didn't draw many students, although there were a lot of students in those days, and were enough. And so I got a little bit of philosophy, but I taught comparative education, I taught educational philosophy, I taught child development, I taught tests and measurements, I taught the master's seminars, I taught problems and issues. I must have taught 12, 13 different courses in School of Education, ranging across three cluster areas while I was here, which was not at all rare at that time. But I would assume I was hired by Peterson and Bryant. That would be my assumption. I had so many connections to the School of Education that it could have come from there. It was the kind of thing where I had no difficulty getting on whatsoever, and I can't remember how it happened. I do remember that the same year I came in, Norma Brandel, who is still here, was I think now mayor of Huntington Beach as well as Sue and Franklin. Norma and I were both, I was 25 or 26, Norma was about 25, 26. And that was not all that, common even then, to come in at that age, even when, people were coming in earlier. And people knew me, but they didn't know Norma, so there was some controversy about where this good-looking girl looking in Counselor Ed came from, and who brought her in and whose protege she was. There was nothing to that, I might add, but, so there was some speculation, but I knew everyone, so there was no controversy about my appointment. Until I'd been there a couple of years and had managed to antagonize a few people, but...
How about the next year after that? Was the faculty consulted about who should be hired, or did you have a chance to look at papers, or did the word just come down that people just appear in September, as you suggested before?
Let me think. You want to turn off the tape recorder while I think, because I really cannot remember. I just to save myself. I think it tended to be pretty much of an old boys network, in the sense that people knew people who knew people who advanced names, and there was a sort of informal consensus. And either the name was initiated by the division, which, by the way, was in the Division of Educational Psychology, which we were together, which was a strange marriage. Either they were initiated by the division and taken up to the central administration and either approved or disapproved, because the ultimate decision was made up there, or the recommendation was initiated by the central administration and again brought down to friendly voices in the Old Boys Network and was worked out that way. But the school was smaller then. It sounds much more arbitrary than it was, because everyone still pretty well knew everyone else. It was in very rapid transition. The place was growing very fast physically. I mean, the student body was doubling in size every year. There weren't enough people to fill positions. You didn't have qualified people even available in certain areas. It was the kind of thing where a lot of action had to... things were done in 15 different ways. It was hard to generalize. It was just a matter of trying to keep up with the growth and all of that sort of thing. So there wasn't the awareness that the whole thing was high-handed, and I don't think at that time we looked upon as being high-handed or irregular. It was just looked upon as sort of the way things had always operated. And
I think in some other departments, yeah, it was looked upon as high-handed.
Yeah, well, I think it depends a great deal on the traditions of the discipline, too, and where people came from. The education department, being a new professional academic division, and very low on the hierarchy status, and not used to, and with not great intellectual pretensions, with more of a professional practitioner type of orientation, was much less sensitive to violations of academic, quote-unquote academic rights, intellectual protocol, and all of that kind of thing than some of the other areas. Looking back, I suspect that one of the issues in the big fight with Ross and Brown and those people against Peterson back having to do with the nature of the college in the first place, whether it should be a liberal arts college or a teacher's college, probably had to do in part with, you know, who had the prerogative of bringing in faculty and making these decisions, although I was not that exercised about that at that time. I was young enough that I was more concerned with the students and with my classes than I was with the politics. I was you were assigned an office when you came in, and I was in an office with two of the ace faculty rebels, Oliver Johnstone and Walter Nagel. And Stoney and Nagel would hold all their political meetings in the office, so I was immediately in the midst of, you know, the coup, and I was identified for almost the very beginning with the revolutionary faction, and I was very discontent with the entire thing. And it was interesting. It was great fun for a while, and then it became very, very tedious because you kept hearing the same thing every semester and every week, and you kind of wanted to get off and get some work done and not have people sitting on your desk, you know, dropping cigarette ashes all over you and bemoaning the fact that everything was going to hell. But such is the way of the world.
I was interested in what you said about education, that maybe people in education saw themselves as having a lower status and were less concerned about academic protocol, and yet some of them were among the leaders of the revolution against Peterson. But I guess you just think it was for different reasons.
Yeah, I think that it's more a matter of psychodynamics, I think, than it was politics in large part with many people in the School of Education. It was more a king of the mountain game. I think it was with a lot of the people. I don't know how much of the discontent with Peterson was based upon conviction and how much it was simply based upon aggravation that, you know, these people were not in the position themselves. God knows many of them, when they got into the positions themselves, turned out to be much worse than the people they were bitching about. The man who replaced the dean, whoever he was, that we threw out about my second year in the School of Education, was so much worse than the man that was thrown out that it was absolutely pathetic. He was a total nincompoop. But he was also a rebel, and of course, if you're a rebel, you can't be bad. You can only be good, and therefore, I think he was probably a rebel to protect himself from being fired for ineptitude. And ironically, you know, this most inept of all of the inept, you know, ended up in the new leader because he was relatively mute, being not very intelligent, and therefore they mistook his. Well, apathy is the wrong word. They mistook his inarticulateness for reserve and elevated him to a higher position where he managed to totally screw up the school in new and unforeseen ways. And as I said before, when I talked to Robbie, I think that the unfortunate thing that occurred here at Long Beach, and I think you're still suffering from the consequences of it in large part, is that it's rather like in the sociology of knowledge or, you know, in developmental psychology, those formative years are so important because that's when the pattern is laid down, you know, the character assumes whatever proportions it assumes, and the whole thing becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy after a while, and, you know, bad people begin to recruit in their own image, who then recruit in their own image, and I'm sure this breaks down ultimately just through complexity and, you know, and subgrouping and all of that kind of thing, but initially you had a cluster on the whole of very, very weak people who drove out a lot of the good people, although some of the good people I think were very unrealistic in what they were doing. They certainly weren't very tactful, and in some cases they were exceedingly intolerant, you know, of simply totally unwilling to suffer fools, fools gladly. And when you're surrounded by fools, you have to suffer at least some of them gladly sometimes. So they brought a lot of the unfortunate consequences upon themselves. But I think that the school of education, which I'm more familiar with than the other schools here, although at one time I was pretty familiar with all of the schools because we were all pretty close together, is still suffering from that. And I don't know what the answer is on what you do to change patterns, other than bring in someone at the top who then hires in a different image. But that, of course, creates grave problems, and you have crises and revolutions generated on that, regardless of the good intentions.
Yeah. One of the questions that brings up, that although I don't know if either of us will be able to answer, is why some good people did stay. I mean, maybe not the majority of good people, but a few good people did stay and had some influence in other departments in getting to hire at least some more people who weren't during mediocre times. As can be shown by the fact that these people ultimately went on someplace else and
were
successful.
I don't know. That's the question for studies is why there is this selective migration of some good people and some stay behind. David Reisman says you can divide university professors into two major groups, cosmopolitans and locals. I think generally that's true, and the cosmopolitans, those that were tied more to the discipline than to the area or the institution, left. The locals, who, while they weren't totally uninterested in the discipline as a discipline, those who were either tended to be rather existential about the whole thing and think the whole world is rather absurd anyway, so you might as well suffer this absurd situation as another one somewhere else where it's cold, stayed in Southern California.
That's the one thing.
Yeah, I think
that comes up among people who, if you say to them, boy, things were kind of bad here, why didn't you leave? They say, well, it's the weather.
Well, I think it is true. I think California seduces a lot of people. I know I would rather teach in a community college in California than teach in a university in New Jersey. And I like the ethos. I like the casualness of Southern California. I like to be able to come home and I can run on the beach. And plus the fact that I really don't take the whole thing terribly seriously. I mean, I'm firmly convinced that if California State College of Long Beach or USC disappeared tomorrow, nobody would know a week from Wednesday. It wouldn't make any difference in the long run. We all dramatize how important these things are they are important to ourselves, but I'm not so sure that whoever said every profession is a conspiracy against the laity isn't true. I don't think many of the things we do are really very important. I don't think we really need 20 state colleges all but an anthropology department. I think it's terribly expensive and terribly redundant. The redundancy in the system. I don't know that we need 47 schools of education in the state. I'm not even sure we need schools. I'm getting very, very dubious about a lot of that. But you suspend disbelief and go wandering on, and that may be the reason some people stay. I don't take the whole thing that seriously. I'm interested in what I'm doing. The institution is simply the place where I work, and I haven't seen any institutions that are particularly effective. The people I know that teach at Harvard, I'm very happy with Harvard. The people I know that come to Chicago, well, they love to announce the fact they're from Chicago, and you start talking about Chicago, we're very unhappy with Chicago. I don't know. I don't know that many. I don't know we ever had that many super people. There aren't that many super people to begin with. After all, how many good people are there? Law's calling on them, medicine's calling on them, politics is calling on them, teaching's calling on them. Of the 5% of really super competent people that are around, and that's a very liberal estimate, there's a tremendous competition for these people, and most schools don't get very many. And I don't think we got very many. I don't think we have very many. I don't think most schools have very many. I think Cal State Long Beach probably has many more than would normally be anticipated because it's in Long Beach, because it's in California, because it's in Los Angeles. And this is where things are at this present time in history. And so people want to be, you know, on the growing edge of civilization. And this is, you know, if you want to be in the center of our times, it's right here, right now. So I think a lot of people will put up with a bad situation in order to stay in an interesting situation.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Dr. McIntosh. Did things seem to you to change when he came?
Yeah, I think they did. He was a good speaker. He was a nice man. I think many of the faculty felt he wasn't terribly academic, and I suspect he wasn't terribly academic. He came from a low-prestige institution, the University of Idaho at Pocatello Branch or something like that. Yeah, somewhere in Idaho, I think it was Pocatello. I think he went back to Pocatello. He was a nice person. He didn't seem to have any strong educational convictions. He was under attack virtually from the very beginning just by virtue of the position that he had.